Good evening and welcome to the Psychic Call Shop. I'm Ace Knight and I'm sitting down tonight to talk with Dr. Steve on his book, The Forgotten Populace, When Farmers Turned Left to Save Democracy. How did you get into the union movement?
Well, when I was actually 16, I shipped out on a bulk carrier for a summer job as a coal passer. And then the summers that followed, I worked as a porter and a pantryman and such, ordinary seaman. And that was my first experience actually being accepted by adult men as an equal and a co-worker. And then during my undergraduate time at New York University in the 1960s, was the anti-war movement and anti-Vietnam War movement, and I became active in that. And I was impressed by, in particular, the United Electrical Workers, which is one of the old left-wing unions that was largely hobbled and nearly destroyed during the Red Scare of the 1950s. But it continued to exist, does to this day. And they had a very progressive and, I thought, complete understanding of what was going on with U.S. foreign policy and with the economy. And I was really impressed by that comprehension of it. And so I, over time, just had more and more associations with unions that included the United Auto Workers when I later moved to Detroit with my wife. And I've been active in the labor movement for the last 40 years.
What have you seen during those 40 years?
Well, unfortunately, for much of it was the decline of the labor movement. And part of it had to do with the industry that I had first become acquainted with when I was younger. That, in a way, was the canary in the coal mine, because the shipping industry, merchant marine, it's the easiest kind of work to send overseas. All you got to do is take down the U.S. flag and put up a Panamanian flag or a Liberian flag. And suddenly your wage costs plummet dramatically. You can pay 5% of what you previously were obligated to pay by union agreement, and you no longer have to abide by Coast Guard standards. And so the U.S. Merchant Marine has been decimated and nearly destroyed by the movement of ships abroad under foreign flags. And that's what's been happening across the board. It started with the Merchant Marine. That was one of the first. But it has now, of course, included a wide range of manufacturing and even tech work that has gone abroad and call centers that have gone abroad. And it's been unfortunate because it doesn't, as often as not, it does not actually aid, as we would hope, those workers overseas who also need work, desperately need work and pay, but they're exploited and underpaid, and they produce goods that they can't afford to buy that are simply exported back here to undercut and diminish the power of organized labor. I think, though, what's been encouraging in the last few years is that there is an understanding among a growing number of younger workers in white-collar work and in retail work and in among baristas and such, that actually collective action is the best way to protect your interest and on the job and try and make for a better life.
I would agree there. Now, you know, I'm, you know, former 1199 ECIU Nurses Union. So I've got a little familiarity with unions, but a lot of people will go, oh, but that was then, this is now. I don't think it's changed. I don't think the situations have changed. I don't think the classes have changed. I don't think the CEO's behaviors have changed. Would you agree?
I would agree. Their tactics have changed. Their strategy has changed, but their interests still are put an emphasis on the bottom line to the exclusion often enough of the welfare of their workers and often enough of their clients and their customers. I mean, we've seen examples where, you know, Purdue Pharma, for example, pushing OxyContin, even though it's going to literally kill some of their customers. Philip Morris doing the same with tobacco. Johns Mansville doing the same with asbestos. Exxon doing the same with, obviously, the product that is now actually producing climate change and puts the entire civilization in jeopardy in terms of a sustainable kind of future for the environment. So, unfortunately, left to their own devices, corporations in a short-term way, a short-sighted way, will maximize their immediate return on investment too often. Mm-hmm. And that requires regulation. And that's what the original populists were about in the 1890s. They were the first ones to raise this kind of need to actually regulate an industrial economy, and at times even replace the profit motive with a different mm-hmm. approach, one that says that cooperative enterprises are preferable often enough, but mm-hmm. worker-owned or farmer-owned enterprises that are private initiative, but on a collective basis, a cooperative effort to develop an understanding of what they're about.
Right. And, you know, something that I think we're seeing a lot with farms now is they're no longer farmer-owned. They're corporation-owned.
Yeah.
Which is distressing to me.
Yes. And that is, I mean, there's much that's similar between the era of the populists back in the 1890s when they first raised these issues. Back then, it was primarily among farmers and coal miners and railroad mm-hmm. workers. Today, that's a different population. Back then in the 1890s, 40%, 45% of the workforce were farmers. Today, it's about 2%. And obviously, coal mining is much diminished, and it turns out to be environmentally dangerous anyway. We need to find alternatives. But a new group of workers, a new class of workers, still mm-hmm. need to find that collective basis for defending their interests on the job.
Especially. And then also, you know, the new gig workers, they need to find a collective interest here because they get sacked on all of it.
Right. And that's what the SAG-AFTRA strike was about. The Screenwriters Guild and the mm-hmm. folks were basically arguing that they work on a gig basis often enough, but they have a collective bargaining agreement that establishes mm-hmm. standards from one gig to the next across an industry basis. And that's an important kind of approach that I think many others might find a useful model. It's hard to impose. You have to organize across a community and establish mm-hmm. also support through a government that is sympathetic to unions and not antagonistic to them, which has too often been the reality in the past.
And currently, I mean, but do you think, you know, we're based out of West Virginia, so we know a lot of the coal history here. Do you think we will see another Beauty Mountain with the government actually sending armed forces in to deal with unions?
I hope not. It certainly was all too frequent an event in the past. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking again of the 1890s and the populists. One of the lead populists of that era was Eugene Debs. He was the organizer of the American Railway Union. And mm-hmm. they went on strike in 1894 during a severe depression when the companies were cutting pay dramatically, but the company housing and the rent and other costs did not fall in anything like the same level. So they were actually on the brink of starvation. They go mm-hmm. on strike, and the federal government sent in army troops and state militias were mobilized as well. And 40 people died, shot mm-hmm. dead on the picket lines, and the union was broken. Now that continued for many years, many such episodes in our history, until the 1930s, when actually the labor movement found new approaches and new ways of resisting that kind of violent counterattack and actually successfully organized unions on a broad basis. And then, as we know, many of their jobs were actually shipped abroad.
A lot of them were, because that's normally the first move of a company that can move things. Now, you brought up something that I found very interesting, and I really hadn't made the connection before. We know about the opiate pour-in in West Virginia from Big Pharma. You know, we also, coal mining central here, and, you know, sorry, the coal mines use up their workers like toilet paper and destroy them. Do you think there was collusion between the coal operators and Big Pharma?
You know, I don't know. They hang out in the same country clubs. They are in the same community, the same class. They're on the same boards of directors. So who knows what's going on in terms of their collusion on behalf of their common interest. But I, you know, that's a matter of speculation. I wouldn't know in that case.
Right. But, you know, that's what we're talking about that was occurring in the 1800s.
Right. And that was actually when it first occurred. And that's what the populace were the first to resist and establish a precedent for all subsequent progressive movements. And they were the ones who said, look, small government is basically a recipe for continued power of these major corporations, because they want a small government. They want a government they can overpower with their amassed power and wealth. And so what the populists were saying is that the government is actually a representative of the people. And if we strengthen our democracy, if our democracy is complete and full, then that government should represent working people and farmers on behalf of their collective interests and force upon industry standards and, you know, legitimate regulation.
Right.
To guarantee that they're working on behalf of the common good and not simply trashing whatever interests get in their way on behalf of maximizing the bottom line. That's what the populists were saying. And they were the first to say that. And not necessarily with success at first, but what happened was, and this is what's important, at that time in the 1890s, both the Republicans and the Democrats, bipartisan support for the robber barons who were dominating that new industrial economy. And neither would respond to the growing needs articulated by farmers and workers on behalf of a different approach, supporting unions, supporting co-ops, supporting public regulation of these new businesses. And so the populace had to form a third party at that time. They didn't have a lot of options. At that time, there were no primaries within the major parties to select for alternative voices to find a base within either of those parties. They were dominated by political bosses who simply excluded any alternative voice. And so at that point, they had to go third party. That's what they did. That's what they did. And they had a very popular program that actually found a growing interest. They elected 50 members of Congress. They elected six governors. They were the first to actually pass voting rights for women. They favored an interracial movement in the South that would unify black and white farmers around common interests. And that, of course, made them a mortal enemy of the white supremacists who dominated that Southern economy. Democrats, in that case, Republicans who were clearly and closely allied with big business. And so the populists were an alternative. They said, we need actually to support unions. We need to support co-ops. We need to actually, if the railroads will not be run in the public interest, and they weren't being run in the public interest, they were usually in bankruptcy. These CEOs were basically operating on behalf of their immediate and selfish interests and profiteering. Price gouging when it came to freight rates, extraordinarily dangerous conditions of work in which over 2,500 workers a year were being killed on the railroads, over 20,000 injured. And these were companies that had been formed by public subsidies. Over 170 acres of federal land was gifted to the railroads after the Civil War from 1865 on, 170 million acres gifted to them. That's the size of the state of Texas. Given to them for free, along with tax breaks, along with subsidized for every mile of railroad laid, along with protections for their debt and assistance in paying the interest guarantees. And for all of those reasons, the populace said, look, these are public resources. That's why we committed those resources to building the railroads. And if they're going to be operated in an abusive manner, price gouging customers and abusing workers, then maybe we should take them over and run them as public enterprises for the public benefit, kind of like Amtrak, which operates, I think, a lot better than the Norfolk and Southern, the private road that just crashed out in East Palatine and endangered an entire community. So that was the argument the populists were making, that natural monopolies, railroads and utilities, actually should be operated for the public benefit as public enterprises. And otherwise, we should support a mixed economy with honest entrepreneurs allowed to operate within standards that actually maximize the public interest, but still would allow for profitability, reasonable profitability, but also cooperative and public-owned enterprises that would provide a mix, a range of alternatives within an emerging industrial society.
Well, speaking of which, so if I'm understanding you correctly, all these trails, all these abandoned trails, railroad trails by CNX, that if you step on, you can be prosecuted for trespassing, is actually public land.
It was not public. It's not now public land, but it was. It was gifted to the railroads. And the populists argued that it wasn't being properly managed, and so maybe they should be returning that land to the public. And to my mind, it's an, an ample argument for arguing for a publicly operated enterprise that actually serves the maximum interests of society, workers, and customers.
Right. And, you know, we just went through 2 years of hell with railroads, with accident after accident after accident. Are we not returning to the 1890s?
It does look that way, doesn't it? Particularly when the railroad companies are arguing that they now should have trains that are a mile or so long, and they would like to have just one worker on those trains. They want to reduce the crews to the bare minimum. And what the unions are arguing for is that there should be adequate staffing to ensure public safety. Seems like a reasonable demand to me. And what I tried to convey in Forgotten Populace is the way in which they were addressing these issues for the first time. And I'm trying to write in a way that's accessible. It's a short book on a big topic. Lots of illustrations, an effort to make it of interest to and appealing to a wider audience of readers who are intelligent and curious, but don't always have a lot of time and really want to know more about this kind of history, particularly because, and this was another reason I wrote the book, so often in the last few years, we're told that Donald Trump is a populist. That Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, and sometimes now even they talk about President Biden as being a populist. What does this term mean when it can be used so indiscriminately? It seems to describe nothing. And I'm arguing that it's a way of evading, in particular with respect to Trump, it's a way of evading what he really is, which is a fake populist. And it's basically a budding fascist. And so it's more polite, more polite to say, he's a populist, a right-wing populist.
Do you think they're bastardizing the term?
I do. I think it's been made almost useless as a term. I don't want to revive use of the term. I'm trying to say that historically, the populists were a very positive and progressive force. And it's an oxymoron to talk about right-wing populism. The populists were about voting rights for women, voting rights for blacks, an expanded democracy, regulation of corporate abuse and outlawing it, and legitimating actually a different approach to an economy, arguing for a market economy, but one that is regulated by and has also the possibility for collective private initiative. That means unions and co-ops.
Right. And not only unions and co-ops, but actually the people having a voice.
Right.
Not only a voice and their job, because I'm sorry, there are CEOs that do not understand how the floor is mopped in their office building, much less what their product is and how it's made. And then they just get more and more audacity behind them. It's ridiculous. And, you know, I keep my eye on a few industries, but, you know, people, you know, I think that America is at a dissatisfaction, a disadvantage now that the railroad system is becoming more and more destroyed.
There, you're talking about the railroads.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and let's be clear. We have repeatedly had to bail out the railroads. Their abusive and inefficient and stupid behavior led to their bankruptcy years ago and the formation of Conrail, which was a temporary nationalization of the railroads because they didn't know how to actually continue their operation. And with that temporary nationalization and an investment of public resources, finally, they stabilized the industry, which now operates with five or six railroads left, major networks. There's a few minor ones, but there's five or six major now railroads that were allowed to monopolize their particular regional economies. And so we're back to where the populists were arguing we were in the 1890s, where basically you have these oligarchs, wealthy CEOs who are running the business on behalf of their private interests.
Right. And, you know, we all, you know, during the Panini, we saw so much talk about shipping and things not being able to be shipped and things not moving. And in my head, I'm like, we have a railroad that literally in West Virginia touched towns that roads did not touch at the time. You're telling me that we disabled most of the shipping situation to prioritize like coal shipments to this gorge, you know, from here out. You know, we've took out these railroads that would have brought the products, especially with the lack of, you know, truckers currently, you know, the trucking industry is so down in employment. It's ridiculous. They can't get enough truckers on the roads.
Right.
Looking back, I think that we're seeing that that was a detriment. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, one of the things that I am always struck by is that when people talk about a shortage of truck drivers, they fail to understand that this is historically determined by the fact that there was a concerted effort to break the power of the Teamsters in trucking. And they weren't entirely successful, but they had enough success to diminish the power of organized labor in the trucking industry to make basically turn trucking into kind of a sweatshop on wheels, where truckers were increasingly going to be driven to the actual margins of sustainable life. And so why would young people see trucking as an alternative that has any future for them? So under those circumstances, there's not enough truckers. There's not enough truck drivers. But that was the outcome of an anti-union, union-busting, and aggressive policy to minimize the cost of labor on behalf of corporate bottom line. And it's had the consequence over the long term of meaning that it's not an industry young people want to move into.
And I think it's because they're not pushed towards that. It's like electricians and plumbers and any other union-based job that's a trade-based job. You know, we're coming up on the holidays here, and a lot of seniors are going to get this question. So where are you going to college at? They're immediately like pre-programmed to be disappointed in the idea that, you know what, I think I'm going over and, you know, taking the trucking course. I think I want to be a truck driver and see America. I think I want to go and be an electrician just like dad or grandpa or, you know, whomever. So I'm going to be going to this trade school. Like, that's been programmed since, what would you say, the 60s?
Yeah, that's been going on for a while, and it is unfortunate that two things have happened, that there was this premium placed on white-collar work at the same time that there was the attack on union power and a failure by the government to sustain labor rights and actually prosecute companies that were breaking the law and violating the labor law of this land. There hasn't been enough effort to maintain those standards. Therefore, unions were less capable of protecting the interests of workers. And there were problems within the labor movement, that it became too top-down and bureaucratic, and some of the leadership became too comfortable with their own immediate circumstances and not enough devoted to the kind of continual struggle that's necessary to maintain a vigorous, democratic, and progressive labor movement. It's not easy to do. In a capitalist economy where unions are seen by a lot of investors, not all of them, but some, as a mortal enemy of their immediate short-term private interests. And so it's a real battle. And the labor movement actually faltered in that regard.
Right.
So what we now need to have is something that actually approaches the whole labor movement in a different way. And that's, by the way, one of the reasons I'm really encouraged by what happened with the United Auto Workers and their
reshare.
I thought that was a wonderful example of an alternative approach in which a new labor movement, a new movement within the United Auto Workers, was able to win the election that not brought Sean Fain into the presidency of that union, and a whole group, new group that became much more devoted to new strategies, new approaches, and said, you know, we've been giving concessions for the last 15 years. And our pay has flatlined and fallen, particularly with the growth in the cost of living. Our income is actually falling, even as the companies are making record levels of profits. Over the last 10 years, the big three U.S. automakers, basically $250 billion of profit over the last 10 years, $250 billion in profit. And they could afford to actually... As we saw, but only after a collective action and a strike on behalf of reducing the gap between workers doing the same job but paid different wages. The effort is to, and focus has been on reducing that gap, bringing temporary workers who are, quote, temporary, but they were permanent temporaries. Think about what an oxymoron that is. So reducing the number of temporary workers, bringing them up to the status of full-time employees with a wage that's now been risen dramatically to improve the conditions of work in that auto industry. And that, to me, is the future that we need to be talking about. And that, by the way, again, has a lot to do with what was going on in the 1890s. That's when a new labor movement was being developed and talked about and contested. There were different ideas about what that labor movement should look like. But finally came to fruition in the 1930s during the Great Depression with the New Deal. And the first point where the federal government stepped in and said, these are the rights of labor. You cannot abuse workers and force them actually to act against their own articulated interests. If a group of them want a union, that union has to be recognized and there has to be collective bargaining. It doesn't impose a settlement, but it does say there has to be collective bargaining.
Right. Now, here's the thing, however, and I think this probably started in the late 90s, this lovely term, independent contractor, that I think is abused by corporate left, right, and center to get out of, or temporary permanent employee, to get out of these. Now, these are gates that I think need to be closed quickly by all unions.
I agree, and I think labor law has to be amended to include an understanding that more often than not, these contractors are actually workers. They're employees. But they're on a leash. It's a choke collar, right, but it is a leash. And that means that in the case of farming, for example, I mentioned earlier that the number of farmers and farm workers is down to 2% of the labor force. But within that 2%, there's a huge range of different circumstances. There are still family farmers struggling to hang on. But there are also a growing number of farmers who are farmers, but they are actually contractors. They are not independent farmers we think of when you see the, you know, the box with the unsalted butter and it has a little silo and a nice farmhouse. When you're talking about chicken farming in particular, pig farming as well, and in a wider range of farming, you find that actually it's companies like Tyson that contracts with these farmers, and the farmers are kept on a really short choke collar in terms of the investment that's necessary, the fees they're going to be paid, the taxes, who's going to pay the taxes. The income of that contractor is strictly regulated and kept very low, and they really are not their own. They're not the independent farmer that we think of when we consider that term from its past meaning.
Right. And then, you know, there's also what I call the border crossing farm workers. They come up, they do the work, they go back. They've done this for centuries now, and they're never included in those numbers.
Right. And particularly coming from the South, and this was from Mexico, south of the border. That's, again, a consequence of changes in federal policy had a really negative impact. And I'm thinking of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement that Bill Clinton signed. And I'm bipartisan in my criticism of the two parties. I'm more inclined to back Democrats, but I'm really frustrated by the history of their slow retreat from the support of labor and farmers. And Clinton was, in my mind, one of the worst offenders in that regard. And NAFTA was a real serious blow to both farm and worker interests. Worker more obvious, I guess, because obviously what happened is a massive migration of thousands of factories south of the border where they can produce the same product at 10% of the labor costs or less. And so this diminished the power of labor dramatically. Unfortunately for Mexican folk, it actually means they're paid a really tiny wage down in Mexico, not one that really can sustain the kind of decent life we would hope for. And all they needed, they can see that if they cross the border, they could be doing the same work and paid 10 times more.
Well,
likewise for farmers in Mexico, what happened under NAFTA was there's a sudden influx of subsidized corn from U.S. agribusiness, from the massive scaling of U.S. of corn and grains in particular, and that floods the Mexican market, and tens of thousands of Mexican farmers are driven out of business. Where do they go? They go to northern Mexico to work in those maquiladora factories that U.S. corporations had set up at a fraction of the pay that was characteristic of those same jobs in the United States. And then they cross into the United States. So NAFTA undermined the farming economy of Mexico, drove those farmers into those maquiladora low-wage factories in northern Mexico. They could see that if they crossed the border, they'd be making a lot more money. And so they did so. And so we have to think about trade policy being changed as well as labor rights. And again, this is what this is what Forgotten Populace is about. It tries to bring it up to the present and talk about how these issues are still resonating with us 130 years later, that the populace were the first to talk about these matters. Sometimes we take for granted.
Well, we take for granted and we just expect that everyone knows this. You know, it's like I was in a conversation the other day and I'm like, yeah, the reason why lettuce is $2.99 a head is because we had such strong border control, lettuce went to waste because they couldn't get workers to go pick it.
Right. And if you pay so poorly, who's going to take the job? Well, they're going to have to be increasingly reliant on a desperate group of folk crossing the border, sometimes without documentation, often enough without documentation.
Right.
So they're at risk. And they are prepared to accept whatever they need to survive. And that's going to be, obviously, a really downward pressure on standards as a result.
And, but the populace, I believe, had a solution for this matter.
Well, what their solution was, and it's hard to transpose from 130 years ago, but their solution was to expand democracy, to make the government more democratic. This includes, by the way, the fact that this is often not understood by folks. U.S. senators were not elected back in the 1890s. They were appointed by the state legislature. And the state legislature was usually bought and sold by major economic interests. So when the election times came, you elected your local congressman and not women, congressmen, because women didn't have the right to vote. And they weren't running for office. So it was all the vote was for the local congressman. And then the state legislature would appoint the U.S. senators. And the populace said, that's nonsense. All you do is inviting the kind of lobbying and backroom deals that means that the position is going to be bought and sold. And so the populace wanted not only votes for women, not only voting access for blacks in the South, they wanted election of U.S. senators. And their argument was, is that if we had that, that augmented democracy, it would be able to counter the abusive practices of these major mega corporations that were becoming increasingly domineering in the U.S. economy. I'll give you one other example. The populace also favored a secret ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Something else people take for granted is the secret ballot. You go in to vote and there's the ballot and you fill it out. Up until actually the 20th century, in most cases in the United States, it was not a secret ballot. You showed up with your own piece of paper and you would write out who you wanted to favor in the election. But more often than not, what happened was is that different parties printed their own quote unquote tickets, and they would be different colors. And this is important in the South, because in the South, Black African-American voters in particular would be told, either you vote for the Democratic Party, the party of white supremacy in the South, and here's the yellow colored ticket that we want to see you drop in the box on election day. That's how they could tell whether or not you responded to the terrorist threat or the bribe in some cases.
Right.
You drop the appropriately colored ticket in the box. And the populace said, no, we need a secret ballot that will actually protect the integrity of that individual's voting rights instead of making them vulnerable to either bribery or, worse still, the kind of terrorism that was all too common in the South.
Right. And that's interesting because we're looking at the same situation, but it's another branch of government.
Well, we're looking now at a situation where lobbyists are able to have their way.
Right. But with, no, you know, because the Supreme Court's appointed at this present point instead of being voted. But then, you know, we also somewhere made, you know, that same Supreme Court made this decision that big corpora actually have Social Security numbers and voting rights.
Well, yeah. And so here we are again. Populists would have put that on their legend as well.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, okay, so how do we go back and back this out? How do we change this? And I think it starts with this, sitting down with coffee, learning from our history, because history repeats. Sorry, it does. If you don't learn the lessons, if you don't teach the lessons like the populace or the color of law, which is your other book, it will repeat itself.
Well, yeah, I actually like the phrase, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does echo.
I like that.
It's different enough as we move along, but there are patterns that really bear watching. And that's what I'm trying to achieve with this book, Forgotten Populace, and make it clear that the term has become now just an abusive bit of slang.
Right.
It's almost like a sly pejorative. I mean, I personally am a fan of Bernie Sanders. I hated the fact that he was being called the same kind of politician as Donald Trump.
See, that's not even true, because Bernie has, A, put the work in. Sorry, he's been in Congress for, what, a couple decades now. B, he walks his talk. I mean, everyone can see that from his gray suit. He walks his talk.
Right. Yeah, and if you may not agree with what he's saying, but you know that he's not bullshitting you.
Exactly. And, you know, he has a proven track record. I don't think that he's anywhere close to Trump.
Oh, I agree. I agree. And actually, in a way, he's sort of a distant cousin of the populace, a legitimate sort of link to their progressive politics, whereas Trump has no such link at all. And I think it's kind
See,
of...
I think I'll disagree with you there. He does have a link to the populace, and this is his link. He's exactly what they were opposing.
Yes, that's right. So he's an anti-populist.
Right.
Yeah, we agree on that. And in fact, I say that in the book as I try to sort out how the populist label, instead of it being linked to the historical reality, became detached and became this sort of abusive pejorative, in a way, attached to anyone who challenges the rule of responsible elites.
Right. You know, and there is no responsible elites. Now, the only thing that I am uncomfortable with in the current labor movements that I know of is that they are not being led by the members of that industry. Example, the president of Teamsters is not a truck driver.
Well, but the Teamsters represent a whole range of workers.
Right.
Keep in mind that it's not just truck drivers. The Teamsters represent right. dozens of different industries. And so
right.
there's a variety of folks that, but I, in general, I agree. I think that, and again, looking at the UAW, Sean Fain is a former mm-hmm. member of the skilled trades from a auto plant in Indiana. So he
right.
comes out of that background and has a grip on what is important to people.
Right. But, you know, and I, you know, when I used to negotiate, because, yeah, I used to sit down at the table and negotiate the nursing contracts for the local union. They never liked me because I knew what that 16 hours that we were agreeing to meant for my nurses on the floor, because I had worked that 16 hours.
Right. Oh, yeah. You know? Well, it's very important. That's the way it should be. And in any case where that's not what people are finding, then they need to work on overturning
that. Right. Very much so. And changing that movement. But so what's next? What are we digging into next? Because you spanned a lot of history there, a lot of history of the labor movement in this very quick book. And it is a seed book, guys. What I mean by that is read this book, then take a topic and go and get into more deep there. What's your next book?
Well, I've been working on a longer book for some years about actually agriculture and some of the issues related to the farming matters that are mm-hmm. are so complicated today. And this book is a portion of what I've been focusing on. I've been trying to bring it up to the present time. And it's complicated and difficult. And so I'm still working on that. We'll see where it goes. It would be a book I was going to call it Empty Silos, The Struggle for Farming and Food. And for me, Empty Silos is sort of representative of how small family-based farming has been set aside in favor of factory farming mm-hmm. and corporate agribusiness.
And we've lost what we see every time is something set aside, quality.
Right.
I mean, look at the number of minerals that your doctor will recommend you getting.
Right.
If we look at 1890, they would look at you and say, what, you're not eating?
Well, the problem in the 1890s is that, and again, this is something I talk about in the book, mm-hmm. people were so desperate that in Kansas, the price of shipping corn to the market in Chicago, the railroads were charging so much that the corn didn't fetch enough on the market in Chicago to pay for the mm-hmm. cost of shipping it from Kansas. And so mm-hmm. farmers in the worst years of the 1890s were actually using corn for fuel and probably eating a lot of popcorn. But they were using the
right.
corn as fuel because it was just senseless to ship it to Chicago when it cost you more than you would fetch on the market.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And, you know, what's even weirder is, and I don't know, maybe this is something that needs to be addressed now again, is where the government would pay farmers not to plant.
Well, and I think that was a program in the 1930s when, mm-hmm. by the way, a lot of the populist reform proposals were actually mm-hmm. enacted, amended, but in a form that's recognizable mm-hmm. in terms of what they were calling for. And the twist that was added in the 1930s was to regulate farm prices, guarantee that farmers would have a harvest that would actually fetch a price to cover the cost of production. That was a
right.
demand of farmers in the 1930s. But to make that possible, given the growing productivity of farming, if you just let it go and go at maximum production, you'll swamp the market with more than can be sold at a profitable level for that individual farmer.
Right.
And I mean, not just profitable, but I mean recover costs. And so the argument was they need to regulate production, to avoid oversupply and swamping the market. Now, that's a tough business because, on the other hand, there's urban folks who need cheap food, who need affordable food. So right. There has to be a public policy that addresses the needs of farmers at the same time it addresses the needs of urban folks who might be stressed out and having trouble making ends meet in terms of their food budget.
Right, but also with the global economy, it's almost like ridiculous because we've pivoted our global economy. Example, have you noticed the price of spaghetti? You know why it's up? Because we lost all the grain in the Ukraine.
Right. Right. And this was, by the way, an issue in the 1890s because cotton farmers in the South, black and white, were forced to compete on a global market with peasants who were living on the edge of famine in British-controlled Egypt and India under the most abusive forms of sharecropping and tenant farming and really living on the brink of starvation. That's who American farmers had to compete with on global markets. So global capitalism is not a new phenomenon. It's become all the more scaled up in recent years, but
it was
also an issue back in the 1890s.
And it's the same issue. They haven't fixed that in 130 years. If this was a road, we'd be in danger. Guess what? We're in danger now.
Right.
You know,
we're in danger now because I think what one process that has been left for too long to make its way is that Exxon and the other major energy companies have been allowed to maximize the production of fossil fuels as a source of energy. And we're now facing a really serious existential crisis in terms of where our economy is going to not just our economy, our society, our culture, our ability to make a living and live a life in a planet that isn't being driven to the edge of an environmental disaster.
Right. And they've also been allowed to disparage and buy out and patents for items that would endanger their business.
Right. And there's a history of that across the board, whether it's cigarettes, whether it's asbestos, right. Whether it's fossil fuels, whether it's right. Purdue Pharma.
Right. And, what I mean by that is, if we look at Texas, everyone knows the problem with the power grid down there. They didn't insulate it. Is this how petty they're being? It's we'll show them that solar power and wind power won't work. We'll just leave out the insulation.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. And we have to be going in the direction of these alternatives. There's no other answer to it. And I think public policy has got to be dramatically leveraged upwards to take control of these issues because people say, well, big government. All right. And big government can be a problem. There's no doubt about it.
The same way,
big corporations can be a problem. In both cases, bureaucracy and self-serving leadership can be a real issue. So what we need is also at the same time to leverage the democratic means by which bureaucracy can be challenged, whether it's a government bureaucracy or a corporate bureaucracy. And to me, they're not all that different.
Yeah. It's kind of like me. I don't care big government, small government. I would prefer common sense government.
Right. But all I'm sorry, whether it's big or small, adequate power to actually make our way in a progressive manner.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Dr. Steve, thank you for sitting down with us. Go ahead and spell out your website so they can go get this book.
Okay.
It is a good book. And make sure to go to Amazon and get his second book that came out a couple years ago.
Right. They can get Forgotten Populist. Go on ForgottenPopulist.com. One word, ForgottenPopulist.com.
Yes. And please come back out when your next book comes out. I look really forward to talking with you again. It was really good to meet with you.
Thank you. I had a great time.
Good. Have a great day, dear.
You too.
Hi, this is Sandy Starr. I'm a psychic and I work on Keen, and I have been working on Keen for over 22 years. You can reach me on 01068. I deal with a myriad of subjects, but I do specialize in relationships, marriages, divorces, is he cheating, is she cheating, whatever the dynamic of the relationship is, I will guide you through. I've got amazing radar for cheaters, so I will tell you the truth if he or she is cheating. I can help with any subject you need me to help you with besides relationships, and I look forward to hearing from you. Again, you can reach me through Keen, and my extension number is 01068. I really look forward to hearing from you and helping you with whatever you need me to help you with.
Hi, I'm Tracy Van. I'm a psychic medium and I work with tarot cards. I also practice Reiki and access bars. I would like to share with you what a reading with me is like. It is a blended reading of psychic and mediumship, and I deliver these messages exactly as they come through. I'm not going to mince words or add any padding. I am a professional, reliable, and honest communicator. I have readings available anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour. You can book a reading with me at tracyvan.com. That's TracyVann.com. And no, I'll always tell you exactly what you need to hear.
Hey everybody, Natalie here from The Pendulum's Path. If you are in need of guidance, direction, spiritual connection, healing, or more, you have come to the right place. I have worked as a psychic and a medium for over 3 years, connecting people from all over the world with their loved ones, giving them insight and guidance into their current situations, their past healings, their blockages, and what they need to know in order for them to have a better future. It would be my absolute honor if you would come to my website at www.thependulumspath.com. Visit my shop. I have a whole bunch of crystals, oils, balms, mystery boxes, and more. And visit my services. I offer 15-minute, 30-minute, and 60-minute sessions. I also have email readings available if you're not comfortable with the one-on-one session with me, or if you just want to try me out. I encourage you to come visit me at The Pendulum's Path, and let's get you back on the right track today.
Hey everybody, Lady Gwendolyn here from Rowan Temple of Light, and I'm here to tell you about our events this summer. First up is Beltane in the Hills, May 13th, and that is from 1 to 6. We have entertainment, we have a bunch of vendors, we have a fairy photo shoot. It's going to be exciting. You having any questions, reach out to Earth Magic or to myself. After that, we have Central West Virginia Pagan Pride, August 19th. That's at Holly Gray Park from 11 to 5 for the day. And we will have Sarah Masters coming down from Pittsburgh to be our keynote speaker. We have some great classes for that. So if you want to get involved, reach out to Rowan Temple of Light at Gmail, or just follow us along on Facebook at Rowan Temple of Light, and we look forward to seeing you out in the community. See you there.
Hello, darling. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you this evening?
Oh, kicking ass and taking names. You know, it's Tuesday. We're having a good day.
Hey, there you go. And Dr. Steve sounded great.
He was. I could have had a longer cup of coffee with him, in all honesty.
We kind of did have a longer cup of coffee with him.
Oh, no, honey. I'm talking like a couple hours because, you know, he is one of those that, you know, I can really get into a good debate with.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So let's start the poll and you plead your case.
All right. Am I the asshole for laughing and asking my mom what she expected to happen when she had my thief sister and her scumbag family over for Thanksgiving? My female 29 sister, female 37, is a drug addict and a thief. She has not gone to jail because she mostly steals from family and friends. Her husband is also a dirtbag, and their two kids are headed the same way. I will not allow them in my house. I will only meet with them in public. I always bring just enough cash to pay my bill if we eat together and don't bring anything else. I don't know why she is this way. Both my brother, 33, and myself have turned out okay. We have educations and careers. We have stable relationships. We are reasonably well-behaved adults, and our kids are a pretty good bunch. My sister just never grew up. She hated rules. She hated that my parents got her to watch me when I was young. She moved out when she was 18, took her education savings account, and spent it traveling around. I was going to host Thanksgiving this year, and my mom mentioned that my sister and her family would be in town. They have not visited for 4 years. She has asked me to include them. Hard no. I said that that wasn't going to happen. So my mom said she wanted her whole family together so her and my dad would host. Well, she just called me. A bunch of stuff is missing from her house. Jewelry, sports memorabilia, knickknacks, stuff that would be easy to sell on eBay or pawn. I snorted and asked her if she remembered why I do not allow my sister in my house. She said that when I allowed her to stay with me, she stole cash from me and her kids stole my stepson's video game. I asked her why she thought they wouldn't steal from her. She said that I'm being cruel to rub it in when all she wanted was family time.
You're not going to like my answer.
I don't know. See, I'm fencing on this one. Like, part of me wants to be like, you're the asshole. You shouldn't say these things to your mother. And like, you know, and then part of me is like, but if I have family members that I know that are going to steal from me and, you know, The family's kind of clear on this. Like, we right. seem to be clear on this. Like, I don't right. think anyone had any questions about, like, this is what's going to happen.
Right.
Is it really being the asshole?
Right.
To just blatantly say, what the fuck did you expect, Mom? Like...
Well, yeah, again, you're not going to like my answer on this one.
Okay, go for it.
Not the asshole.
I don't know that I disagree. I think I'm there at not the asshole. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think I would not like your answer because, like, you have a different rationale or just...
Well, it's like people do not change their behavior. I don't remember who said it, but when someone shows you who they are, except that.
Yeah. I definitely understand thinking or more importantly not or getting caught up in the idea
right.
that we're going to have everyone over, it's going to be a happy Thanksgiving, it's all going to be awesome, and then being, you know, devastated when stuff is missing.
Right.
But I also think that there's something to be said for, and what else did you expect?
Well, like, not only why is the mother continually in denial? Like, that's my bigger problem.
Well, here's the deal, though. I think this is a situation where, and hopefully this is the year, like, Mom learns.
Right.
There's a lot of different ways to have Thanksgiving and have right. everyone together.
Right.
But don't involve setting yourself up to be stolen from.
Right.
Like, you can meet at a restaurant. You can rent out a, you know, 4-H camp or some other such thing, a venue. Mm-hmm. You can do this in a hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's other options you can make.
Right.
That limit, or just frankly your own property, limit access.
Right.
We stay here.
Right.
If you don't like this, I'm sorry. That's the best I've got.
Right. And putting up things that actually matter.
Yeah.
All right. So the poll is up. We want to hear what you guys think. Feel free to make live comments. We'll be glad to talk about it. All right. So let's move over to relationship advice. This one's an interesting one.
Yes, I, male 27, found out my friend group placed bets on my relationship with female 27. I, male 27, found out my friend group was betting on my relationship with my girlfriend, female 27. I, male 27, have a problem with my friend group. Too long, didn't read. I broke up with a friend group of 7 years over a bet they made about my relationship. Excuse the formatting, as this is my first time posting and I'm on mobile. I'll try to and keep this as short as possible, but as I can, but the friend group is four people. Mary, 27 female, who I'm currently dating. Sean, 28 male, and Anna, 27 female, who are a couple, and Pete, 27 male, who is married. To give a brief bit of history, Pete and Mary dated for 3 months over 5 years ago, and he is now happily married. Anna and Mary were best friends, and Sean is primarily just Anna's boyfriend. This all started around 6 months ago when I started hanging out with Sean and Pete. I consider them to be pretty cool guys, but was a little wary of Sean as he seemed very closed off. I was dating my ex at this point and was on the way out of that relationship when we started spending time together. I met Mary around this time, but we were just acquaintances. The other four had been friends for around 7 years. I broke up with my ex around 2 months later. It was around this time that Sean talked about wanting Mary to have a threesome with him and Anna. We joked around a little bit or a little about this, but the advice I provided is it would cause more issues than anything else. And that was if, by some miracle, Mary would agree. Fast forward a month, and Mary and I have started talking. I check with Pete to make sure he has no issues if I take a shot at her, and he says no. A few weeks later, we are dating. Anna, all of a sudden, hates me and starts trying to convince Mary not to see me, but to no avail. Fast forward a month, and Sean lets slip that the entire friend group is placing bets on when we will break up due to some childhood trauma Mary has. I told him I thought it was a really shitty thing to do, and he advised that it's not a big deal and I'm overreacting. I tell Mary later that day what transpired, and she is incredibly hurt and upset that Anna would do that to her. At this point, I'd made it clear to both Pete and Sean that they had really upset me, but neither had much to say other than you're overreacting and it's not that big a deal. This, in turn, caused a lot of things to come out of the woodwork, including the reasoning behind why I stopped being invited to events shortly after I started dating Mary. Pretty much, Anna and Sean didn't want me around. My question is, did I do the right thing by informing my girlfriend as to what was going on? Sorry if this is a mess, but I think it's all there.
Okay. So I'm going to put it this way. Yes, it's a mess, but how often have we seen Mary in a relationship? Because we all have that friend. They meet the love of their life. 2 months later, the love of their life has disappeared.
Okay.
Back again, the next love of their life, their next boo thing. You know, we really stop investing in how many boo things these people have.
Okay.
Do I think it's optional to take bets? Yeah, I think it could be profitable for the right person. Do I think you're bad for telling your girlfriend what her friends are doing? No, not really.
I think the bigger problem here is that you got told about it in the first place.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's one thing, like, I won't say that there hadn't been some commentary, not actual ledger kept bets placed. But just that general kind of like, you know, I bet this is over in 6 months. Kind of comments. I think that occurs in all friends groups.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know I have had friends that I've been like, I bet you this doesn't last till the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just unfortunately the you know, like it is it inappropriate? Probably.
You're right.
Is it common? I think also probably.
Right.
Because it's not that you really don't want them to be happy and be in a relationship that's stable and all the things.
Right.
It's just sometimes it does, like you say, it gets repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, I found the love of my life. He's the scum of the earth. I found the love of my life. He's the scum of the earth.
Sorry, like, I know people that change boyfriends more than I change cigarette packs. Like, there comes a point when I don't invest in their name.
Yeah. Well, and yeah.
Yeah.
But there's also the realities of the fact that you... And I think this is where this friends group is age-wise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're all pretty much in that the 20s, late 20s category.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those adult learning lessons where you don't say some things out loud.
Well, this is one of those adult learning lessons when you don't, you know, it's like most couples that when they meet and they tell me, oh, I'm so in love with them. I go, have you planned their death yet?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And if they can't tell me that, I don't invest in them.
Yeah, that's an important relationship step.
Right.
But I also think there's some things you don't say.
Right.
About your friends, even, you know, no matter how, like, funny or whatever, or not a big deal you think it is. I think sometimes you have to watch what you say.
Right.
Like, it's not wrong that you're sitting here having this moment of, like, I give this 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that part is a friends group. I think it happens a lot more often than most people would admit. Like, oh, right. No, I would never say such a thing. Oh, yes, you would.
Yes, you would. Furthermore, I have a deeper question.
You've thought it. Right. If you haven't said it, if you and a friend in a friends group have not looked at, not said it to each other.
Right.
Y'all have exchanged that look.
Right.
That's like.
Well, see, I've got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
How much is your normal bet?
What do you mean, how much is my normal bet?
I don't know. I normally put $20 on 6 weeks.
No, I don't, like, I'm not even saying, like, to actually go there and this is a real legitimate money bet. I have dropped before, like, $5.
Uh-huh.
$5, this doesn't make it to the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, we've heard this one before.
Yep, we've seen this one before.
Okay. Like, I've had one friend in specifics that comes to mind, and I really think this helps sort of to illustrate the point. This dude managed to date like 15 people in a row with the same first name as him. I got so lost with. We'll call him Adam. Adam broke up with Adam and started dating Adam that he then broke up with and started dating Adam. And then he broke up with Adam for Adam. Stop. Let me know when he gets a boyfriend that has a different first name.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't track it. I can't keep up with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, hi, Adam, right? Like, is the point you get to. It's right. The point you get to is you just assume you're probably another Adam.
Right.
Like, let me know when the first name changes.
Well, you know, and for me, it's like, oh, you switched models. Same refrigerator, just switched models. Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you didn't learn from the first one.
I mean, the first time it was cute. The second time it was like, that's kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
And I truly got lost. I don't know how many actual times this happened, but it was like 15.
Right.
Or so it felt, because it just got to a point that it's like, I stop. Mm-hmm. Don't even tell me.
Right.
Like, I don't want to know. Let me know when the next one has a different name.
Right.
And then I'll occasionally decide to pay attention to that.
Right.
Who is now, like, happily married, has a wonderful relationship. Like, everything's great. But
back is it with an Adam?
No.
Cool.
Totally different name. Like, total different life. Like, many, many things changed along the way. But I do think that it's common to have that mm-hmm. idea when you're watching the same things repeat.
Right.
To be like, $5, this doesn't make it.
Right.
$5, this blows up over this.
Right.
And it's because we sit there and we watch the same right. scenario play out.
Right.
And it's like, wow, really? You know?
Right.
Is it a bit callous? Yes, it is.
Right.
And it's not because your friends don't care about you. It's because this is like, hi, do you want your V8 moment yet?
Personally, I like making the money.
Like, do you want to get smacked in the head today so that I can be like, hi, wake up.
Right.
Stop doing this.
Right. But this is like, normal standard behavior. You know, normally it's, you know, someone's going to be paying for the loser pays for the, for us
really good
going coffee. For really, really good coffee. Yes. Sure. Yes. Very much.
Now, mine's usually $5 if I even make an actual wager. But even then, it's not even, I've never taken that as a serious bet. It's just the realities of, you know, and I don't, none of my friends have ever taken it as a serious bet when I've said these things, because it's usually one of those moments of like, yeah, I'm not even going to wager that because you're right.
Well, see, so, I'm the awful one because most of the times I win. And I like making the money, especially when I see a clear pattern of behavior.
Oh, yeah. Well,
you know, Facebook inserted a rule for 48 hours for one of my friends. Like, do they cannot change their partner for 48 hours.
Oh, gosh. I don't think it really changes anything if you really do wager money.
No.
And place an actual bet. Right. I do think, however, it is one of those things you have to learn to do discreetly.
Right.
Because no one ever likes finding out
mm-hmm.
that their friends are sitting there going, oh, yeah, $5, this doesn't make it to the week, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. This doesn't last. This doesn't make it to the weekend. $5, mm-hmm. they have daddy issues.
Yep.
Because we all have at least one of those friends.
Yes.
Like,
you know, that needs to go find a daddy because they have daddy issues.
No, I mean that they date someone with daddy issues. That,
right.
Like, I'm sorry. Does everyone have at least one Captain Save-A-Ho friend?
Yes.
That is just like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Who they date. It's the same person every time. Mm-hmm. It's just like, take one of their partners, put them on a Xerox machine, spit out multiple copies. It's the same thing. And it's like, oh, big surprise, has daddy issues.
Right.
Big surprise.
Right.
Gonna have a lot of insecurities. Gonna need a lot of attention. Gonna start a lot of drama to get the attention.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is ever going to be easy. And mm-hmm. you know this is the same person they date every single time. So then you start saying things like, $5, she has daddy issues.
Mm-hmm.
And again, no, at least in my friend group, no one took that one seriously. As a wager, it was just like, we know.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. we know.
Right. Alrighty then, let's take a look at the poll. See where we're at. No, you are not an asshole for reminding your mother of the record of your sister.
Which is kind of interesting how these two kind of go together.
They do.
Because Thanksgiving sibling could have just as easily said, $5, Mom, she steals everything you own.
Mm-hmm. And I would collect that bet.
You know, that would be one that would be like, pay up, Mommy dearest, pay up.
Yes.
Yes. So, yeah. And again, is it cruel that, does it make it worse or different if it's family members?
No, not at all. They are your best moneymaker.
God, like, what did you, like, was your first hustle at Thanksgiving on like your grandmother?
No, not at all. No, it was my aunt. I could literally bet how many people, if that boyfriend would make it home to Christmas or not.
Fair enough, fair enough. Long as you collect the wager before or after the aunt leaves.
Exactly.
After she leaves, pay up.
Yep.
Pay up.
Mm-hmm. Told you she wasn't bringing him back in for Christmas. I will take my Sprite now.
There you go. Alrighty.
Alrighty.
Time to get us out of here.
Time to get us out of here, baby.
All right. So, of course, we want to thank Beverly Walker, Mika G, Kathy, Mary Winfield, Brenda, Shannon C, Shannon D, Lady Gwendolyn, Charles Shaw, Tracy Van, Caitlin Bell, and Devin. If you'd like to learn more about us, the show, or how you too can become a Patreon supporter and receive all the wonderful benefits our baristas receive, please visit us at pcspnetwork.com.
Awesome. And we guys will see you tomorrow.
Tomorrow? What are we seeing for tomorrow?
Tomorrow's Wednesday. The baristas are coming for their station meeting.
Oh, yeah. We'll see the baristas tomorrow. And if you go ahead and go over and pay $1, $5, or $10...
Yeah.
We'll see you too.
Oh, goodness. Okay. So how's your day, Joe? How's your day been, Joe? So while I'm uploading something.
Alrighty. So there is that. Well, I've been on the road. I was trapped in a car with your mother. No. She watches. I can't say anything bad.
Mm-hmm.
No, seriously though. I've been on the road today. It was actually really, I was surprised for as cold as it was. The weather stayed really, really good. So we didn't have to worry about that while we were out today for that, Superdoc trip.
Yes.
So we got all that taken care of. I got Red Bulled. Oh, our favorite restaurant is now closed at 3 again.
Oh. Damn it. He must have broke up with the girlfriend.
I'm assuming. But yeah, they're closed at 3 again.
Right.
So we did Arby's. Mm-hmm. And for the most weird thing to come out of my mouth in forever, I had a French dip.
Right.
Like, I shocked myself. Like, it came out of my mouth and I went, all right, I guess that's what we're doing.
And how was it?
It was actually really good. It was right. It was exactly what I needed. I was kind of happy about it.
Right. So we guys will see you later. Bye, y'all.
Bye.